Hello and welcome to the podcast on negotiation, and today with a super experienced guest, with Mike Inman. Mike, great to have you with us.
Remy, thank you for having me. I'm not, don't make it sound like I've got years, because, you know, we all want to be as young as we can.
That's true, but when I stalk you on LinkedIn, and then when I read the information on your LinkedIn profile, I find 7,000 educated B2B negotiators. I find over 1 million deals that you've negotiated. I find.
Let's walk that back. I haven't negotiated a million deals.
Billion. Fact, it says billion.
Well, that's in dollars. Yes. But the deals itself, and this is a particular thing that's debatable sometimes, how many negotiations we do. So some studies say it's 5 to 7 negotiations every day that we miss. But those are kind of mini negotiations. And then there's purchasing negotiations. Hey, call a supplier and get them to expedite the freight. That's technically an opportunity to negotiate. So I'm going to look at it on the large scale, 500 plus RFPs, $500,000 plus at the table formal negotiations is the largest chunk of my negotiating experience. That makes sense.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. And that's, although you're trying to be modest, but hey, come on, admit it, Mike, you're a pretty damn experienced negotiator.
I've been around. I got to experience a lot of different negotiations in different industries, with different bosses, different peer groups, different functions. I had the pleasure of taking a more manufacturing traditional negotiation experience and moving it into things like HR and marketing. Places where purchasing was frowned upon, because purchasing is those cheap guys over there, and you know, it's very relationship based, and how dare you put in a negotiation which could be competitive in a field that thrives on relationships. So I had to change some techniques and tactics to work in those industries, so I get some experience doing that as well.
When was the first, Mike, when was the first time you thought about yourself, do you remember, as an experienced negotiator?
As an experienced negotiator, I resist using that word experienced, because I consider myself a lifelong learner. So I've gotten experience negotiating, but certainly there are people with more experience than me. And people with less experience who do as well.
Probably more of those that have less experience than negotiation experience than you.
Well, let me talk about experience in a different context. I'm going to remove myself, because there's an ego and a bias that comes with ourselves.
True.
When I teach, and you teach, I oftentimes get a mix in my classes. There will be one of our clients in particular, they had us teach their new hires. So imagine 24 people, new hires right out of university, and they just want to learn and they want to go apply what they learned in college, university. The way we price our model, there was a few extra seats. So the client said, hey, do you mind if we put some experienced people in with the new hires? And I said, yeah, good idea. And I noticed something very interesting, especially in the first negotiations we conducted, the new hires were doing better than the experienced people. And there's very objective ways in our role plays to measure who's doing well and who's not. Right. And I started to pay attention to this. I saw this trend. It was very apparent that the young people did better. So I started asking them questions. And here's what came out of it. The younger people told me almost 100% consistently, we just did what you told us to do. We followed what you said. When I asked the experienced people, you know, hey, you didn't do so well in that. What happened? Well, Mike, you know, in my experience, and they would start talking about things they had to unlearn before they could relearn and implement new ideas into what had previously been successful for them. So experience can be a dangerous thing sometimes if we rely on it, if we say, I know what I'm doing, I got here. Mm-hmm. Great, until the next new person comes along who learns some new techniques or implements them better, and you get exposed because you're a little bit lazy as we get older. And I'm guilty of that myself.
Well, we all are, right? I mean, human beings are generally lazy, both in terms of a mental activity as well as physical activity, right? Sure. But Mike, let's go back to the basics, right? When you hear experience, yes, let's try to define it together. Yeah, let's try to define it together. What does this word mean? What does experience in negotiation mean?
Well, I think it has to do with using the skills that we learn. We read articles online, we read books, we take classes, but then there's actually implementing that learning. And if you do it one time, and whether you are successful or not, you've gained some experience. And I would argue we learn more from our failures in negotiating or anything in life than from the successes.
Right.
And you do it a second time and a third time, and you get reasonably comfortable and confident. You're not making as many large mistakes. You're having more successes, small or large. So you start to gain confidence. Now, this is where there's a little bit of danger here. There's experience as a negotiator, and there's experience in your function negotiating. And what I mean by that is you could be a software as a service salesperson, and you're the best salesperson on your whole team. You're the best service salesperson in the whole company. Your deals are the largest in revenue and have the most margin in them, and the clients are happy too. So you're really, really strong as a negotiator. But are you strong as a negotiator in something else? Can you take those knowledge, skills, and abilities that have proven very successful in software as a service and move them over into manufacturing? Mm-hmm. Can you move them into a marketing service? Can you move them into different areas? Now you've shown we've gone from experience into what I'll call expertise, which are two very different things.
Correct.
Experience the same thing over and over again. You can refine yourself and get a little better each time and reduce the opportunities for error. But if you can move it into a new area, now you've shown a level where it's gone beyond just the same old experience, and you've become some level of expert in that particular case.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, if I understand you correctly, when we talk about experience, we talk about knowledge, we talk about perception, we talk about familiarity, yeah, with a process, with a situation, with an event, right, that we encounter over and over again.
With a person?
With a person, yes, exactly. That we somehow repeatedly encounter, right, or have to deal with, right? So, but if we take this as a definition, as our definition of experience, and try to go a step further, right? This definition doesn't say anything about the results, right? It only says about how many ends, how many times we've encountered a particular situation, person, event, or what have you, right? What kind of impression we got, what kind of knowledge we've accumulated, we've aggregated, we've acquired once it has happened. Yeah? So how can we turn experience into valuable experience in negotiation?
Okay. So you're onto a great point. You do something over and over again, you're reasonably good at it, you haven't gotten fired, but does that mean you're good?
Right.
Or does it just mean you've reached the base level of competence that keeps you from getting fired?
Right.
So I like to look, when I'm researching someone, looking at their background, I like to see what other people say about them. Have their bosses been a reference for them? That's an indicator of how well they got along with their boss. Let's say their boss is lying about them, but their boss at least liked them well enough to leave a reference for them.
Right.
That could be the case. What does their boss say about them in the reference? That's interesting. What do their peers say about them? Their internal customers, if you will, people that they work with. What do they say about them? Are they promotable?
Mm-hmm.
Have they performed well enough with their peer group on any team to get promoted to the next level?
Right.
And that tells me a level of competence or excellence at what they do. in building out that profile of the other side.
Right. So let's try to apply this. I mean, we've been super. We've tried to be super intellectual and theoretical. Let's try to move into practice and put you in the spotlight again, Mike. So how was it with in your career? Yes. How did you develop your experience? Yeah. Yes. And how did that development led to, let's say, superior rather than average results?
Better than average results, I'll say. So this is where it got fun for me. I started my career. Well, first of all, I came out of university as an engineer, and I couldn't find a job as an engineer. I wasn't a good enough engineer. My CV wasn't very good to get an engineering job. And this is an American engineer. I know German engineers have a much higher level of competency. So I ended up in sales, and I did the sales job for about 3 years before I realized that I was average. And I didn't want to be average. So I developed a survey. I passed it out to all my peers. And what came back was everyone that was in a very good seller had been in purchasing before they went into sales. And that didn't make sense to me. So I asked my boss, I said, you know the survey? And he rolled his eyes. He said, oh, I've heard all about the survey. I said, well, do you know that everybody here was in purchasing before they went into sales? And he said, yeah, I could have told you that before the survey. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, listen, Mike, we as salespeople, we understand the other side's sheet of paper. We understand when we work with the end user community, when we have a relationship, when we have the only capacity or capability in the world, or we're one of very few suppliers. And on those deals, we work to close them at high margin because that's what we're paid to do. And on the other side, we understand if we're the third or fourth or fifth bidder, if we're just being brought along to fill out the bid sheet to gain power and leverage for the buyer. And on those deals, we're still professional. We're still polite. We're building a relationship for the future. But he said, Mike, I've noticed you come in early and you stay late. And this is my technology at the time. I had a fax machine programmed to dial my beeper so that when a quote came in from the customer, I could hurry up and quote it. He said, Mike, you're working really hard, but you're not working really smart. And I said, yeah, it would be fascinating to know when I probably had the order and I could work on those deals, prioritize them. And when I didn't have the order, I could lose fast, get out of that deal. How do I know? And he said, you're a smart guy. 8 or 10 years in sales, you'll figure it out, probably. Or I know a hiring manager over at General Motors. They're hiring buyers right now. If you'd like, I could put your CV in front of the hiring manager.
So and your said, boss well, wanted to get rid of you.
Well, maybe. No, Keith's a nice guy. We're still in touch. He still might have wanted to get rid of me. And I said, well, if I was a buyer, how long would it take me to figure out? And he said, a year or two tops. You definitely figure it out. And the voice in my head said, that sounds efficient. A year or two in purchasing versus 8 or 10 in sales. So Keith gets me a job at General Motors in the purchasing department. And because I understood the sales sheet of paper, my negotiations, they were very good in the short term for me and General Motors, because I understood how to manipulate a salesperson. I understood how to create fear, uncertainty, and doubt and make a salesperson make concessions that they wouldn't ordinarily make. And so let me give you a tactical example of that, a real world example. I would, I'd let the bids come in from the suppliers. They'd stack up on my desk. I'd wait for the due date to hit. I'd wait for the supplier to call me as the buyer, and they'd say, salesperson, they'd sound like this. They'd say, hey, Mike, we submitted our bid a few days ago. And we were just wondering, how do we look? They're scared already. Without even looking at their bid, I'd say, are you kidding me? You're way too high. Do better. Click. Then I go play Mahjong and Solitaire, some of the games. Later that day, the next day, I'd get a phone call from the same supplier, and it would go like this. They'd say, hey, Mike, you were right. We had finance sharpen the pencil, and we can give you an 8% discount. How does an 8% discount sound? Without even looking at their bid, I would say, 8%? You got to be double digits if you're serious. Click, back to Mahjong Solitaire. Or I would call a meeting with a supplier I had no intention of doing business with, someone that was desperate. And I would take, just abuse them. Then I would call a meeting with a supplier that I really wanted to do business with. And I would say, I've already met with your competition. I can get all this stuff from them. I'd cover the name because that would be unethical. If you can't beat this deal, you're going to lose this order. and I was really good at it. But here's the problem, Remy. That type of abusive, you can call it competitive, I'm going to call it abusive negotiating, drove hundreds, if not thousands, of suppliers out of business with those type of negotiation practices. So I woke up one day and I said, you know what? You're better than that. I can't beat people up for a living. I can't be that person. So I started to study negotiating. I read books on negotiating. I took classes on negotiating, like the one I now teach. Mm-hmm. And from that point forward, my career went from, I was a buyer, I went to a manager, to a director in the GM system. I moved over to America West Airlines, which is now American Airlines, where I had all the indirect spend. From there, I moved to a company called IAC Interactive Corp, which was the owner at the time of Expedia, Hotels.com, Match.com, Ticketmaster, Home Shopping Network, large companies on their own. My job of head of purchasing there was to get all these companies to negotiate internally so that we could have one voice and then go negotiate with our suppliers. And then my last job, I was one of the heads of procurement for MGM Resorts International, where I had all the indirect spend there, 10 strip properties, 50,000 hotel rooms on the strip, and many others in many other countries. So my career progression took off as soon as I started to learn about negotiating in a less abusive, competitive way, and to start figuring out how to be collaborative. Don't hear something I'm not saying. I'm still competitive, but I want the other side to like the deal, not just beat them up and have to take the deal. I want them to like the deal, to be happy with the deal. Now, I want to be happier, full disclosure. But that's when I started to learn how to really use the other side sheet of paper. How do I make this salesperson, this company I'm working with, happy with my business? So what that means as a buyer is, can I add extra volume? Can I give them exclusivity? Can I give them an extra year on the deal? Can I introduce them to another business unit? Can I help this salesperson, this company, reach their revenue and margin targets differently while I help my company achieve our budget goals, our cost savings mm-hmm. goals, our quality goals, our delivery goals, sometimes our revenue goals at MGM, because we had assets that would turn around and become opportunities for a supplier to buy from us.
Right.
So to grow this pie, to make it a bigger deal, I don't like small deals. I like to work on big, complex,
$1 billion deals
that both people can work on mm-hmm. and enjoy while I'm getting a better deal for my side. I have a fiduciary responsibility. I get paid by my boss directly, my clients directly, to produce value for them. Now, what I've learned is I can produce more value for them if I produce value for the other side as well.
Mm. That sounds super impressive. Yeah, that sounds super impressive, Mike. That sounds like to me like there's a lot of repetitions. Yes, repetitions meaning leading to experience, but there is a turning point in there as well. Yeah. So it seems that experience alone doesn't help us become a more successful negotiator, right? It seems that in the first part of your career, you were not happy with it. Sound at least that's how it sounded. You were not happy with your performance, but you were still an experienced negotiator. And something was missing.
Word performance. There's results, and then there's the path to get there.
Right.
My results were making my bosses happy.
Right.
I was happy. I was achieving my goals, but my path to get there, I wasn't happy with. Does that make sense? I didn't like the way I was achieving the results. I didn't feel good about myself.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense. But then something happened, right? Something happened, and then your repetitions became different.
Yes.
I was going to ask you about that very moment. So, what was this turning point? How was it? How did it? Let's say, change the way you perceived your job, the repetitions, your experience, how were the repetitions after the turning point different than they were before, especially in terms of your performance?
I don't remember the aha moment. I am getting to be that age. I will say it be the abusive negotiations were almost too easy. You know, General Motors, a small deal for me would have been $8 million. That just because when you take a $70 part and you buy, you know, 100,000 of them a year, the numbers get really big, really fast.
Right.
So it almost got too easy. The suppliers were so desperate to win orders from us that their desperation caused for them to allow for them to make a lot of concessions without asking for things in return. And not that I want people to have hard jobs. We should have easier jobs. And with AI and all this stuff coming along, jobs will get easier or more complex. But I just thought this is too easy. I want a challenge. So if this is a good deal, how can I make it a great deal? And what I couldn't do with my existing abusive skill set was go from good to great. Good was going to be good over and over and over and over again. And good was going to be easy over and over and over and over again. To get to great, I had to do things differently. Well, that's just the realization that I made.
Oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. On the path to greatness, right? On the path to greatness, it seems that you've incorporated a new dimension into what you perceived as excellence in negotiation, and that included the satisfaction or the relationship satisfaction with the deal of your partner and the relationship with them. Yes, is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. What I learned on the purchasing side, primarily 3 years in sales and 12 years in purchasing, is that if you beat the supplier up, if they're happy enough, okay, I got the order this quarter, I met my number this quarter, it's not a great margin number, it's not a great deal, but it's good enough. When you need them to come in early, to stay late, to come in on the weekend, to do something special, to expedite a service, to change a team, they're not so quick to do it. They're not so happy to do it. I want my negotiating partner to look at me as somebody that they actually want to have a long-term relationship with. And this is a huge difference between the crisis negotiations and business negotiations. In crisis negotiations, and don't hear something I'm not saying, it's the highest form of the craft. You're negotiating over a human life. But that's a one and done. You're not going to send Christmas cards to each other. You're likely never going to see each other again. Maybe in a court case you will. You actually hope that you won't see the person again. In business, you're going to see this person over and over and over at a weekly basis, monthly basis, quarterly basis. You're going to have to re-engage with this person, hopefully often. At the renewal, there's going to be another negotiation. So you need to have a real relationship, not a fake relationship, not a quick relationship. In a business context, it's a higher priority than in a crisis side where you need to get the person out of crisis. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing this. It sounds like a transformative journey, transformative story, right? From a hard bargainer I think you describe yourself as an abusive negotiator, right?
Describe myself as that. Yes.
Yes. To a negotiator who incorporates relationship as one of the one of the dimensions of negotiation performance, right? So that's a long way from these two negotiating types, right?
It's a long way. Let me give you some insight into me. So I'm going to show you a picture of something that's behind me right now, because I know as an abusive negotiator, I know that if I just relax and sit in silence, I'll create fear, uncertainty, and doubt. But I don't want that, Remy. I want for people to enjoy things. But I know that sometimes my face is just intense, or when I relax, I look mean. So behind this camera, that is right there. It says smile because I want to enjoy life and I want people to enjoy things. So that's a tactic that I use to remind myself to be more friendly and approachable, because I know that I can appear not friendly and approachable. You got to know yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Too. Exactly. Absolutely. And you know, when I relax, I also tend to look as an abusive negotiator, right? We have a question from the audience. And by the way, guys, if you're listening and watching us, you're welcome to post your questions, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we possibly can. Alexander, Mike, but doesn't the type of negotiation depend on the company's objective? Mike, in my opinion, you have described the classic Ignacio Lopez method as an abusive as abusive negotiation. However, the result of Lopez activity for OEMs was a loss of quality. This type of negotiation was just an expression of the lack of long-term goal setting and the lack of real negotiation management at GM and other OEMs. Yeah. Mike, what do you say?
So I've had the pleasure of interacting with the doctor several times online. I've not had a conversation like this with him, but that comment right there shows he really understands history and negotiations as well as some of the details here. So Lopez came into General Motors, and I did not work for Lopez. I post Lopez, I was there at a time where General Motors was almost bankrupt. One of the many times they were almost bankrupt, and he came in and he saved the company. Pre-Lopez, there was a lot of, hey, let's go out to a three martini lunch and maybe go to some clubs, and then you'll send me the purchase order. There was a lot of that type of relationship, non-professional business awards. Lopez came in and said, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to have real professional negotiations. They're going to be at our facilities. You shouldn't need to go to a nightclub to negotiate deals. You're going to do it on premise. By the way, because we're going to save you your sales marketing budget, your expense accounts, General Motors expects that to come back to us in a form of cost savings. He got General Motors working together, Cadillac and Chevy. Hey, you're both buying wheels, you're both buying tires, you're both buying mirrors. Why are you buying two different ones? Let's, or at least use the same common tooling or processes, things like that. So there was a lot of good stuff that Lopez brought in. And then he got a little power hungry, or power took over. And I think that's what the doctor's expressing here. Lopez would invite suppliers in. There's a famous story where Rockwell, he brought them in and he said, I want a 10% discount or you're going to lose the order. Ripped up their contract, literally. And Rockwell said, come pick your tools up. We're not going to do business like this. Walked away from General Motors business. Mm-hmm. But a lot of suppliers said, okay, 10%. Yeah, we'll give you 10% because the volume was so big. So the Lopez tree, and of which my partner, Mark Kenzik, used to work for Lopez. In fact, Mark was his data guy. Mark says the day Lopez left General Motors, he was asked to produce reports, and he wheeled out a cart of boxes of paper with every supplier, every part number, and every price in these boxes. And Mark didn't know why, but you don't question Lopez. And Lopez left the next day with all that information. But Mark was involved. He was on the staff with Lopez. But those type of practices, and what the doctor said, lost General Motors not only relationships, but quality and delivery. Suppliers stopped bringing General Motors innovation. They said, oh, well, if our margins are going to be small, then that's good enough. Put it in the box. We'll ship it anyway.
Right.
So General Motors quality started going downhill. And to this day, if you ask someone on the street, what's a better quality car, a Toyota or a General Motors? Remy, what do you think they'll say?
I wouldn't dare to answer this question.
Okay. When I've asked, people say Toyota. But if you look at the JD Powers, any objective criteria, General Motors has improved their quality to they make excellent cars now. Not to the level of the Germans, but but they make excellent cars. But because for so many years their quality was so bad, perception in the consumer it's not quite as good.
Yeah.
So when you abuse people, they will eventually get you back. It's really hard to scale back and have success together.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Mike. Yeah, sounds like it. I hope Alexander is happy with the answer that he has just heard. Guys, if you have other questions, please share them in the chat, in the comments. We're gladly answer as many of them as we can. Mike, let's switch to the other side. Do you prefer to negotiate with experienced or inexperienced negotiators?
Oh, I much prefer experienced people.
And why?
So this has come up in class, this question. And here's what happens. When I'm negotiating with somebody who's inexperienced, they don't really know what they're doing. It becomes a little awkward sometimes because they read about a tactic that they want to try, but they don't know how to do it well. The process can take long because they don't know if it's a good deal or not. They haven't decided what a good deal looks like. So they don't really know what they're doing. Maybe they don't have approval from their boss. And then once you have what you think is a good deal, now maybe they have to go back and shop it internally. It's just kind of awkward. Or worse yet, this is the biggest mistake I see. People won't even try to negotiate. An inexperienced negotiator tends to see things as a take it or leave it. I could never try that. I could never ask that question. I could never ask, can they do better? So for me, it's kind of hard with an inexperienced person. With a more experienced negotiator, complex deals can actually happen faster and better than with an inexperienced person. Now, I'll give you an example of that. At MGM, we were going to, our CEO was directed by the board to improve our player database management. We were getting tired of hearing about how Caesars, our biggest competitor, was getting written up in Harvard business journals for having excellent player database management. So the CEO tells me, the CIO, and the CMO, by the next board meeting, we will have a solution in place. We got 3 months. So the CIO, the CMO, and me, we get in a room. We come up with a strategic plan that we're going to present to the board. And this was our big strategic plan. We're going to copy Caesars. We were going to go get the same supplier, and then we're going to leapfrog them with that same supplier. You know, do it a little bit faster and go to the next level before they could. That was the strategy. Now, to do this well, we wanted to get three suppliers to bid, so we had competition, and that was our policy. So we called in their biggest competitor, Aprimo. We called in SAP, who also had some player database management software. Some time goes by as we're getting these meetings set up. All three come in. We all meet at the Bellagio, these big corporate tables. It's a high affair. But we're going to go with Unica. That's the company we're going to go with. We end all the meetings, and we start to prepare for the negotiations with Unica. Part of the due diligence, we start doing some research on the company and the people who work there and run the company. And the head of, Annika was the director of IT sourcing for this space, comes into my office. She has a piece of paper, slides it across my desk, and says, "Mike, read this." "What's this?" "It's a press release. The CEO of Unica is taking his entire company, he's going to shut down the company to go see the movie 21, Bringing Down the House." That's the movie about the MIT card counting ring. Yeah. "And the reason he was going to shut down the company and take all of his employees to go see this movie was because he was in the movie. And I don't mean as an actor. He was one of the MIT students who was trying to bring down the house. Now, Unica's got 40% of the player data on the strip. We've got 40% that we're going to deliver him on a silver platter." And Annika's like, "We can't give them the business." I'm like, "Absolutely not." So we went up the chain of command, and we decided there is no way we can give them business, because had they done something unscrupulous, and I'm not suggesting that they would, but there was a risk there. So now we're 2 months into this. We got 1 month to go before the board meeting. So I called in Aprimo. Mike Hipps, their vice president of sales. And I said, "Mike, you got a real shot at this." Now, what he didn't know was that Unico had just excluded themselves, and he didn't know that I had 30 days to get a 68-page agreement put into place. But I said, "Mike, come on in here. We're gonna talk about this. I want you to go in that office down the hall, and I want you to come up with your top three priorities for this deal. not your open position target bottom line. I don't want to know the details. I want to know the three terms and conditions that are most critical for you in this deal. And then in a half hour, we're going to get together. We're going to exchange papers and we're going to see if a deal can be had. And a half hour later, we got together, we exchanged papers, and we saw, since the big things were something we could both agree to, all the little stuff fell into place after that. But Mike's an experienced, high-end, excellent negotiator, and we were able to put together that deal and present it in front of the board in a very short order, even though I didn't have any other good options. You know, under the table, my knees were shaking a little bit because I had to get this deal in place. But Mike and I worked it out. We made it work because he's an excellent negotiator.
Mm-hmm. So that's that makes sense. So you prefer negotiating with someone. It's like dancing, right? It's better to dance with someone who knows the steps, right? So you is okay, good. So Mike, now imagine this: we organize negotiation competitions, yes? And you got a greenhorn, somebody who has no idea about negotiation whatsoever, comes up to you and says, "Well, listen, I want to go to this negotiation competition, to the negotiation challenge, but I have no experience. What shall I do, Mike? What would be your advice?"
So I'm going to say, I will be an optimist. We have a lot to work with because we have a blank sheet of paper. So I would say, hey, maybe you should read a book on negotiating. Mm-hmm. There's several good ones out there. I would strongly advise, if you're going to be in a negotiation competition, look at the type of competition it's going to be, whether it's going to be a crisis negotiation or, and by the way, there's some bots out there that are kind of scary. They resemble a hostage negotiator and you've got 1 minute to get the person released. And at the end, if you don't get them released, like
everything explodes, it self-destructs.
Yeah. Or is it a business negotiation or is it a political negotiation? These are all very, very subtly different, but important differences. So find out what's the end result of the negotiation competition, what type of cases are they going to have, and then find a book that's written by somebody in that particular space that will help you. Second thing I would say is to either take a course if you have the time, or to go to a practice session like our friend Phil Brown runs, Taster Practice Sessions, where you actually get to practice negotiations in a little 4 minute, little chunk it out. Totally fun. I've been on three of them already, and now Phil
are awesome,
back and forth.
Yes, so Phil,
I'm sharpening my own skill.
Yes, we're shouting out to you a big hello and kudos to what you're doing with your practice sessions.
So learn a little bit, practice a little bit, and then maybe do a little bit. Maybe go buy a case study. There's several out there that are, you know, hundreds in libraries from some of the leading institutions in the world. Remy, I'm sure you've got availability that people can buy yours. I don't know that for a fact. I'm assuming that you have a library that's accessible to, it's either open source or you can purchase. And to negotiate with somebody in the room, just like you would in a competition. If it's going to be on Zoom, I would say you should practice in Zoom. If it's going to be in the same room, I would say get in the same room. Make it as similar to the actual competition as possible. And don't be afraid to fail. Can I share a story about Phil?
Oh, like, yes, absolutely. Because, you know, we learn from fundamental logical principle. Yeah. Implication says we can learn from false and correct premises. So, yes, absolutely. Let's learn from failures together.
So, Phil, Phil wanted to do a little session. We were just going to get together. We were going to negotiate over apples. And the premise wasn't so much the end result, but it was the process. So we were just going to take a tactic. He's got these cards, negotiation cards, and each take a tactic and just practice the tactic. That's it. No expectation we'd reach a deal. So we get together and we do this 4 minute negotiation. And now my tactic I was supposed to practice, Phil didn't know it, was pause, consider, respond. Now, pause, consider, respond is something that I do as a authentic, natural part of the process, but I like to go fast. I don't want to take unnecessary time in a negotiation. So in this 4-minute negotiation, I was using pause, consider, response very unnaturally. Under the table, I was like squirmy. I'm like, oh, this is really uncomfortable for me. I wouldn't ordinarily use pause, consider, response as many times as I did in this negotiation. And again, it was only 4 minutes. At the end, we had this guy critique us. So Fred says, Mike, you look really natural doing that. And I'm like, oh no, Fred, under the table, I was squirming. I didn't feel good about using this tactic, but the practice of using the tactic will get me more comfortable with it. So even myself, as an experienced person, I've got to push myself a little bit to try some new things, try some things that are uncomfortable. And if you fail at it, that's okay. No big deal. You didn't lose your job. You didn't lose the promotion. You didn't lose the deal. You might have lost a little face, but you picked up some knowledge. So I would encourage people to just practice more. And even in their personal lives, I talk a lot about business negotiations, but there's all these opportunities throughout the day to practice negotiating. The famous one that I use all the time when we go to a new restaurant, and my wife does not like negotiating. That's okay. She's got other assets that are wonderful to the family. When we check in at the host stand, the host will say, would you like the bar or the restaurant? Inside or outside, a booth or a table. There's always a binary choice. And I always say the same thing. I'd like to sit with the best server. And they look at me like, huh? And I say, you know, the server that trains all the other servers. Because if I'm going to pay full price, and my wife has made it very clear that I am not allowed to negotiate over the price of food. I want the best experience possible. Everyone has to start somewhere, but I don't want the trainee. I want the senior person with experience that's going to know how to make sure that my food comes out correctly. Now, here's where they miss an opportunity. The host should say, can you wait 10 minutes because they just got sat? And by the way, if you have a good experience, will you leave us a review on Yelp, on Google? So now I get what I want and need from this deal, which is a great experience. And they get what they want and need out of this, which is word of mouth advertising. It's not about winning, splitting the difference on one deal point. It's about, I got to get 100% of what I want that's a priority for me. And they should expect and try to get 100% of what's a priority for them.
Makes sense.
So yeah, to practice negotiating, practice asking for things the average person wouldn't get. If you pay the retail price, you're agreeing to be average. If you just sit where they'll sit you, you're agreeing to be average. What I'm saying is dare to be better than average and ask for how you're going to get there.
That sounds intriguing. Let's test it out next time. Okay. I have three more. What are the drawbacks of experience? What are the points where we have to be really, really cautious when it comes to negotiating in a context or with people that we know really, really well, where we feel that we're confident and we know almost everything about it?
So there's an old saying here in the States, if all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're trying to build a house, you could be the best hammerer on the planet, but that's going to be a really funny looking house. if you just use the hammer on it all the time. So I would say one of the risks of experience is we get too comfortable in our own successes. So we do the same thing over and over again. And we fail to realize that maybe a hammer isn't the right tool for this particular house to build the driveway, to build the landscaping. We shouldn't use a hammer to do that. So I would say the risk of experience is you tend to get comfortable with certain tools and techniques that work for you. The other risk of experience that we actually teach as a part of our classes is salespeople tend to come in and think, I'm in sales, I'm here to give things away. I'll give you expedited delivery, I'll give you a better team, I'll give you better quality, I'll give you better warranty, can I have the order? And experienced purchasing people tend to be takers. I'm a buyer. So, hey, supplier, I need a discount. I need for you to move this. I need for you to paint it blue, paint it dark blue, paint it gray. Do that for me and you can have the order. And both sides miss an opportunity. If sellers think they're there to give things away and buyers think they're there to take things, that's fine. You can end in a deal that way. But you miss the opportunity to make it a better deal for both sides if salespeople just give and buyers just take.
Right.
So that tends to be a risk of experience as well.
Mm-hmm. So routine is good. It improves our efficiency, but at the same time, it exposes us at the risk of ineffectiveness, right? I mean, of doing.
I love that you used efficiency, and I do want to be efficient.
Right.
I don't want to be so efficient that I miss opportunities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Mike, with all your experience, with all those years and millions of dollars that you've negotiated and the value that you've created for your employers over the years, do you still see areas within the spectrum of your negotiation skills which you would still like to improve?
Yes. I need to learn to ask questions better. I've found that sometimes when I ask a question and I'm genuinely inquisitive, I want to learn, I can come across as an adjutant. The person who's asked the question feels I'm asking it in such a way that is trying to manipulate or expose I can't get into their brain because I'm just trying to learn. I just ask a question. So I need to learn to craft my questions better so that people's anxiety is lower. I think I'll get as good or better answers, and I'll have better relationships if I learn to ask questions better.
Yes, questions, asking questions and listening to the answers. This is how we find out what we don't know, right? I mean, when right. we speak, we only repeat what's already in our head. Whereas the key to solving the puzzle of a complex negotiation is finding out, you know, what are the pieces on the other side of the board.
It's the primo negotiation. Go into that room. I want to know the three things that are most important to you.
I'm right.
not saying I am not saying I will agree to them.
Right. Just getting the priorities. Yes.
They are.
Yes, absolutely. So, Mike, we have a job off. Before my last question, let me show this one. So, Peter,
yes.
let me read it out loud so that our listeners can also hear it. So please, let's negotiate to reduce global warming. Are you able to help, Mike? That sounds like a challenge, right?
I just forwarded a post the other day, and I understand there are people on, I don't want to say both sides of the issue, but the credibility of some of the scientists is in question with some people. And the
right.
solutions that are in place, are they really green with the mining and the rare earth elements and the movement?
Right.
There's things that have to work themselves out. But here's something I think that works for everybody. And this is one of the things I love about being in Europe, Remy, the trees, the public spaces that European cities tend to have more of than we have here in the States. If more cities would plant more trees, we would have more carbon dioxide absorption and more oxygen produced and lower temperatures. I saw the post I forwarded said it was something like there was like a 4-degree difference in Celsius between cities that had lots of trees in public spaces and that didn't have any.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would think every city should say, wow, 4 degrees, that's amazing. We should do that. It's the right thing for the planet and it makes it look better. The problem is you have the industries that are built around different solutions. And at least here in the States, we have politicians who lobbyist by the politicians. So there's some dynamics that get involved with curing global warming, with the easy practical things that we could all agree on in global warming that make it hard to do.
Right. So Peter, it is a challenge. It does involve a lot of negotiation. And in our negotiation competition, by the way, we did challenge our participants with a negotiation setting which was based exactly on this setting. Yes, meaning we had we had developed and developing countries on one and the other side of the table, and their representatives were asked to come up with a joint proposal. Yes, with a joint proposal, how to mitigate climate change. within a few within a spectrum of a few hours of our negotiation round. But reducing global warming starts with our individual decisions. So the only person that we need to negotiate with is
ourselves. I have a vessel, right? Because this is reusable.
There you go. So Mike, my last question is always the same. Yes. It's about greatness in negotiations, or symbols of greatness in negotiation. So if you look back, or if you scan your memory for greatness, for great negotiators, contemporary, historical leaders, non-leaders, completely up to you, who comes to your mind?
I thought about this question, Remy, because I knew it was coming.
It's always a fixed point in every interview.
I'm not going to mention any. And here, and I thought about the reason why that I couldn't come up with any. See, we don't know what's on their sheet of paper, and we don't know what's on the other side's sheet of paper. We only see these final deals, you know, the Paris Accord, or something that happens at NATO, or a business deal that gets announced. Google negotiates with Apple to get the search traffic to Google, and it's apparently $20 billion in business.
Right.
Is that a good deal or a bad deal? Good deal for who? Bad deal for who? What does good look like? We don't know what's on either side's sheet of paper. So therefore, we can't say who did a better job negotiating that deal. We just know that they reached agreement. Sometimes we shouldn't reach agreement. There's, you know, the saying, every negotiation starts with no, and there's the book Getting to Yes. And I've seen too many deals on the business-to-business side that should not have happened. They were bad deals for one or both. They agreed to them anyway. And 6 months later, 3 years later, the two sides were like, well, I hate you. I'm never doing business with you again. When in reality, they should have, at the very early stages, said, oh, this doesn't look like a good deal for us. Hey, listen, I'm going to walk away. I'm going to find somebody else to do business with, buyer or seller. I like you. Maybe one day in the future we'll do business. But the best deal is no deal. Now, see, that's another difference between us and crisis. Crisis negotiators don't have the option of no deal. It's a really bad day when that happens.
So
a business person should be willing to walk away from a bad deal. So I don't have any person, do I say, this person is my idol, and there's lots of people I want to talk to and learn more from, but I can't say that they're excellent negotiators because I don't know what's really on their sheet of paper.
Yes, Mike, I'm not going to give up that easily.
Okay.
So now assume, let's wipe off real people, and let me rephrase my question. So what criteria would a person have to fulfill, and that you would call a great negotiator?
I love that you won't give up on it, Remy. And I've been called a dog on a bone twice, because when I want to know something, I'm going to ask it differently in different ways and multiple times into different people. So congratulations on that. Now, here's what I'll say. I have my own cognitive biases. Things that I respect or things that worked for me, and therefore they're going to come into my answer. So one of those is, can the person display that they were routinely recognized, rewarded, promoted? Mm-hmm. Because results speak. Mm-hmm. Not just one time. That can be luck. Is there a consistency there? Mm-hmm. I will say, what their bosses, peers, and coworkers, subordinates say about them. And by the way, that includes the other side. As a buyer, do you have salespeople saying, I liked negotiating with you, or vice versa? Mm-hmm. Now, that can be a little weird because the dynamic of a buy and a sell side, and they have to do business together, so they might say nice things about each other. But are there people saying that you're competent? Not you saying about yourself. Are other people saying you're competent? That's an indicator. And then lastly, I would say, can you apply your skill in multiple arenas, multiple functions, multiple industries, multiple countries? Remy, you run an international global negotiation competition. I'm just going to assume here, I haven't been in your competitions. I can't wait for the opportunity. But the Latin cultures versus Nordic cultures negotiate from a different foundation.
Correct.
Exactly. Asian cultures, it's different. If you think you're a great American negotiator and you're going to walk into China and just negotiate like an American, they're going to destroy you.
That's correct.
They have different techniques. They use them differently. And that goes in verse. If a Chinese person comes over to America, it may not work out well for them. So can they use it, display proficiency in different cultures, functions, right, industries, I think is an indicator of excellence. Did that answer your question better?
Oh, yes. I think you've mentioned three dimensions. So one is consistent delivery on substantive outcomes. Yes, plural. Second, I think if I understood it correctly, is sustainable relationships. Yeah. So what do people say that interact with us, with me, with the person, with the negotiator? And three is strategic flexibility, right? Meaning, am I able to adapt, or adaptability maybe, right? Am I able to adapt to culture, settings, context, and so on? Yes. So that sounds amazing, Mike. Thank you so much. We're going to slowly wrap it up. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and wisdom, Mike, and your experience. Guys, be aware that experience is not just mere repetition of negotiations, right? We need something more. We need structured feedback to become better. We need to challenge ourselves and never stop learning. So thank you so much. And until the next time on the podcast on negotiation. Thank you, Mike.
Remy, thank you. Thank you, everyone.